Hello and welcome to Was Bitcoin Bringt, the Bitcoin podcast from Vienna, Austria, presented by Coinfinity. Today I do have a very special guest. I'm doing another English language interview, one that I've actually recorded back in February before this whole podcast even started. Alex Gladstein, he's the Chief Strategy Officer for the Human Rights Foundation, also the organizer of the Oslo Freedom Forum, and he's a very, very well-known Bitcoiner. We talked about how Bitcoin is a problem for dictatorships, for authoritarian governments, how Bitcoin is an alternative in countries with high inflation. And since we've done this interview, a couple of countries with high inflation, including the one I'm sitting in, were added to this growing list of countries with problems. So the interview has not lost any of its value. Maybe it even gained in value. And I'm glad I can finally present it to you today. Coinfinity is Austria's first Bitcoin broker and your partner for the long-term Bitcoin strategy. They have excellent support and fair prices and a focus on customer satisfaction. Coinfinity is a firm run by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. You can find their physical store in the city of Graz and reach their website from everywhere, coinfinity.co. Apricot Media is the first, only and best publisher of German language books on Bitcoin. Their bestseller is the Bitcoin Standard by Seyfettin Amous. On their website apricot.media, you can order books and pay using the Lightning Network. Incrementum is an independent asset manager, a fund manager and a research firm based in Liechtenstein. The Incrementum partners Ronald Stöffele and Mark Waller are experts on the topic of sound money and the Austrian School of Economics. They published the legendary Ingobi Trust Report, where I am also an author. Find them at incrementum.li. I'm talking to Alex Gladstein, the Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation. Hi, Alex.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very fine. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Thank you for taking the time. I was just listening to the Lex Friedman podcast that you did a couple of months ago in October. But I want to start with another podcast that I actually listened to today. This is going to be listened to in the German audience. There will be subtitles, hopefully. And I want to start at the top. There was a podcast. It's called Football Weekly. It's actually about soccer. I like it very much, but The Guardian. And they actually had Peter McCormick on to talk about the football club that he was buying. And they also had a tech editor on, and he talked a good, you know, he knew what he was talking about Bitcoin and crypto and whatever. And he said, you know, Bitcoin is always the iPhone and has not revolutionized the world like the iPhone has. Do you think he's right? Do you think he's wrong? Or is Bitcoin just slower than smartphones?
So Bitcoin has revolutionized the world. So that person is just, I mean, I'm not familiar with who that person is, but that person is not educated on the topic, I guess is what I would say. It is true that more people use an iPhone today than use Bitcoin. That is true. There's something like 200 million Bitcoin users and obviously, there's more iPhone users than that. But I think that Bitcoin will certainly outlast the iPhone. That's for sure. And second of all, it's kind of like, it's a strange comparison because the iPhone didn't just come from nothing. You know, it was a new version of a mobile phone that had internet connectivity and a touchscreen that was designed very well and very brilliantly. And is a standard of excellence for the industry. But I mean, people were using mobile phones for, more than 15 years, you know, in different variations before the iPhone was released, back in 2006, I suppose. The iPhone is just, has just so much more technological history in terms of users. Like, you know, there were millions upon millions of mobile phone users when the iPhone already came out. Like, yeah. You know,
and there wasn't a centralized like phone comp, one like big giant phone company that was had all the power, right?
Yeah.
Like the central banks do today.
At the end of the day, it doesn't really make any sense to me, as a comparison. But Bitcoin has revolutionized the world, and it has given tens of millions of people access to a different kind of money system that they are using today all around the world. And that maybe that's just something that the mainstream media doesn't know about, or you know, doesn't want to look at or refuses to acknowledge for whatever reason. But that's the reality.
So 90% of the people in Bitcoin are either from the technical side or from the economics. You're a humanitarian, chief strategy officer of the Human Rights Foundation. Can you tell us like a little bit about yourself and how you ended up thinking so much about Bitcoin, why it's so important to you?
Sure. Well, I have a background, as you say, in human rights. I spent a decade working with people living under authoritarian regimes around the world at the Human Rights Foundation from 2007 to 2017. You know, not really thinking too much about money or currency in that work. Money and currency are not part of the human rights discourse, and it's not something that normally comes up. And if it does come up, it's like an isolated example and not part of a coherent discussion. So I had been exposed to Bitcoin earlier, and my organization started accepting Bitcoin back in 2014, but I didn't really start to look at it seriously until like early 2017. So about 5 years ago, I started to like, dig in a little bit more. And I kept digging and digging and digging. And I had been hearing from activists in our network about their money troubles. And, you know, some of them turned to Bitcoin. And I learned from them. And I asked them why. You know, I remember asking one particular activist from Afghanistan why she would use Bitcoin. And she explained to me quite simply that, you know, the people in her community had phones, but the banking system was controlled. And like women in her case, like were not able to easily open bank accounts, and they weren't even really easily able to use cash, as like their male relatives would kind of like take it from them and kind of prohibit them from interacting financially with the world around them. I mean, they would basically keep them sealed off and powerless. So along comes Bitcoin, and this person starts using it in her company and communities back in 2013. And you know, it's a big revelation because it allows people to have a parallel financial system outside of the traditional one, which is much more exclusionary, predatory, unfair, and corrupt than most people acknowledge or understand. Especially in a global sense.
So, it's even unfair when they're not really trying to be unfair, right? We had this story in India a couple of years ago when there was like a reform, when there was bills taken out of circulation from one day to the other. And especially women were killing themselves because they saved that money and they couldn't go to the bank and exchange it for the new money because then their husbands and
right.
fathers
I mean,
would see it.
Yeah, you're referring to demonetization event. And, you know, I think the really cool part about Bitcoin is that it's yours. No one can demonetize it. No one can debase it. No one can remotely confiscate it. No one can stop you from sending it to someone else. No one can discriminate against your use of it based on your ideas or race or gender or anything like that. It is truly, in a pure sense, freedom. And you know, very simply, like if we acknowledge that, like it's bad for governments to shut down the bank accounts of people they don't like, and that constitutes a human rights violation and discrimination, then, you know, it follows that a technology that allows people to fight that is pro-freedom. I mean, that's a simple way of thinking about it. You know, Bitcoin is a parallel financial system that, you know, allows you to avoid the current system, which is a system of control and surveillance and discrimination. And it's open to everybody. And, you know, it can't be geopolitically controlled in the way that today's system is administered. I mean, essentially, you have the US dollar and people in Washington and New York making decisions for everybody else in the world. And I don't really think that's fair. I've benefited personally from that. I have immense financial privilege. I'm an American who has benefited a lot from the dollar system. But, you know, I think that in the future, we're going to have this open and neutral system where, you know, 4% of the world's population doesn't get to make the rules for everybody else.
I can relate to this. I can show you like hundreds of people in Europe in very powerful positions who will tell you about this, because I mean, this is basically how the euro came to be, as an alternative to the dollar and getting back some sovereignty. But at the same time, you don't really see, especially not on a European level, you don't really see politicians arguing for Bitcoin. But you do see that in the US. Where do we stand in the political sphere in the US? How much of a political a power is Bitcoin already?
Oh, it's becoming a thing. it's happening, I would say. I mean, you have senators, congressmen and women who are pro-Bitcoin, holding Bitcoin, advocating for the rights of Americans to have Bitcoin. You have a broader cryptocurrency industry that's very powerful and wealthy, and they're now lobbying against the banks or with the banks, whatever they're doing. It's becoming an issue on Capitol Hill in America. Are you pro-Bitcoin or are you anti-Bitcoin? And I don't think it's going to be a very successful platform for a politician in the United States if you're going to be anti-Bitcoin. We have tens of millions of Americans that use Bitcoin already. And I think that aligning yourself with a draconian Luddite platform is going to end poorly for you, regardless of your political platform, regardless of your political party. I think the big issue now politically in the mainstream media is the misunderstanding of Bitcoin mining. And that's leading a lot of people to believe that Bitcoin's like bad for the environment. So that's kind of the major challenge right now in the Bitcoin discourse in the United States. But that's largely an American creation or a European creation, this idea that like Bitcoin's bad for the environment. That's a figment of people's imaginations in this part of the world. It's not as much in the discourse elsewhere.
But there are states and politicians who welcome Bitcoin miners in the US, right? Texas, Wyoming. So there are people who get it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, they know that it'll bring jobs and opportunity and freedom. And that Bitcoin mining will help revolutionize the energy industry and help monetize and harness sources of renewable energy that are otherwise, you know, not usable.
Coming back to the question of human rights, I have this book here. You might know it. I don't know if you know it. This is the German version of the little Bitcoin book that you wrote. You were one of the co-authors, and I highly suspect that you were instrumental in writing the chapter 4 on human rights. Mm-hmm. It says why Bitcoin is important for strengthening human rights. Could you explain why it is?
Yeah, well, the reality is that 53% of the world's population or so lives under an authoritarian regime. So you're talking more than 4 billion people who don't live in a system of laws and freedoms where they don't have, you know, ways to push back against government overreach. And that leads to a money system that's broken and used against them. You know, where you don't, in a world where you don't have any way of pushing back against the government and forcing them to reform and holding them accountable, then, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And essentially, the government turns the banking system into something that benefits themselves first. And then secondly, you know, it can be used as a weapon against their critics. So oftentimes in authoritarian regimes, you see high inflation, meaning, you know, a high rate of loss of value of people using money, currency that a government creates. You see things like capital controls, governments trying to prevent citizens from using other currencies. You see confiscatory policy with regard to things like gold or dollars or even bans. You basically see like governments trying to force their citizens to use this like bad fiat currency that they can extract value from and rent seek on. So that's the everyday story of billions of people. I mean, you could argue that like the dollar and the euro are essentially similar, but due to the power balance in the world, these currencies are much more strong and desirable and not as volatile. And, you know, don't suffer the same kind of inflation as you see in places like Sudan or Iran, right? Or Lebanon. So in authoritarian countries, it's very common for, you know, essentially the currency to be broken, for citizens, you know, to be not very easily able to access the outside world. And that's where Bitcoin comes in and is this human rights tool. It allows you to connect to anybody else in the world. It gives you that freedom. It gives you that freedom to own something. It gives you that freedom to transact. It gives you that freedom to speak, essentially. It relates to free speech. It relates to privacy. It relates to private property. And it's a powerful check against authoritarianism. I mean, at the end of the day, tyranny is powered by money. And that is often done in an arrangement where that government is sustained by control over the money. If you take that control away, that tyranny is not going to be as effective. You know, I think there's a dilemma now facing a lot of dictators that are starting to look at Bitcoin maybe for its properties with regard to helping them go outside the U.S. financial system. So like Mr. Putin is like obviously thinking about this right now. You can see it. They're wavering on this topic.
Putin loves anything that gets him out of the dollars and the SWIFT system.
I mean, yes.
He's been trying to come up with an alternative for decades, almost decades.
Yes, but, and this is a point made by Saif al-Din Amous in his book, The Fiat Standard, which I'd recommend. Putin doesn't like the dollar, but he loves his own fiat currency more than he hates the dollar. he doesn't want to give up control of the ruble. Okay. So while on the one hand, he's interested in Bitcoin potentially as a source of revenue for the state in terms of turning all of these like renewable energy resources or even fossil energy resources they have across that country into money where it otherwise wouldn't be feasible to do so. And I think he's interested in using it potentially as a way around U.S. sanctions. What he doesn't want to see is Russians using Bitcoin. So, you know, and you can see this on display with Navalny. You know, Navalny's campaign has been raising millions of dollars in Bitcoin over the last few years. And there's nothing the Russian government can really do about it. And it frustrated them to no end, to the point where they actually stopped repressing Navalny's normal financial accounts because at least they could actually see what was happening there. When they would close those down, then the campaign would go into Bitcoin and the government wouldn't know what's going on. So, you know, I think that there's a dilemma here with dictators where they're going to be interested in Bitcoin as this like open and neutral system that can't be, you know, kind of US controlled. But, you know, they start to realize that if it spreads, and Bitcoin's like this mind virus, it spreads like really quickly. And I mean, over time, I mean, it's unstoppable in my opinion. They're not going to want that mind virus in their country. Like they're not going to want people to have this idea that they can have money that the government doesn't control. That's a very dangerous idea if you're a dictator.
Absolutely. It's even a dangerous idea if you're a democracy, if you're honest. Sure. But if it's unstoppable, what are they supposed to do?
Well, I mean, this is the Trojan horse adoption theory that they have no choice. At the end of the day, they will eventually adopt Bitcoin because their own currency won't be very competitive. Fiat currencies over the coming decade are going to continue to decline in purchasing power. And Bitcoin's going to continue to increase in purchasing power. So these central banks are going to eventually adopt Bitcoin. They're going to convert their increasingly worthless fiat currency into increasingly more valuable Bitcoin. This is like going to happen. Already is happening, obviously, in El Salvador, and there are several sovereign wealth funds already who are exposed to Bitcoin companies like Anchorage and MicroStrategy, etc. We're just getting started with this. I mean, I think that eventually they will adopt, they will try to have it both ways. They'll try to have sort of state control of Bitcoin, meaning they'll mine it at the government level, and they'll, you know, try to use it as a central bank reserve, and they'll try to take it from the people in the same way that the Cuban government tries to take dollars from its people or hard currency from its people through the scheme called the MLC. So you can start to envision how a state might attack Bitcoin in this way. So in Cuba, basically the state prints worthless pesos to pay workers and to pay the public sector. Okay. Mm-hmm. Those worthless pesos are not permitted to be used in the state-run stores that actually sell the things that people need. Instead, you have to get something called MLC, which is like a gift card. It's like a credit system. And the only way to top up your MLC account as a Cuban is through foreign hard currency. There's no official way to turn pesos into MLC. So you basically have to get like friends from abroad to send you euros or Canadian dollars or whatever. And the government takes those and it tops up the citizen's account accordingly. And then they can go spend that balance at an MLC store.
And what do they do with the worthless pesos that they work for?
The worthless pesos that they work for, they have to trade in the black market for a crazy rate to get MLC. So you can't go to the bank with your pesos and buy MLC. You have to go to the black market. And instead of being 24 pesos to the dollar, which is the official rate, you're paying 100. Okay.
So MLC is basically like a Cuban government run stable coin. That's very weird.
Yeah, it's not it doesn't exactly track the dollar. It's essentially based on a basket of currencies, but it's not a thing. It doesn't exist. It's a credit system that you top up, and it's denominated in MLC.
Okay.
But the point is that it's a scheme for the government to print money and in return get hard assets. So I think that you'll see this. I mean, if you think about what's happened in history with like in America, the US government in the 30s, you know, told people you can't have gold anymore. You need to come give us your gold. And in return, we're going to give you these notes, you know, at a rate of whether it was $20 per ounce or later $35 per ounce of gold, right? So the US government needed that gold to pay for FDR's social programs. So it like hoovered up all this gold from all these people in America and gave them instead paper notes that were not redeemable for gold. This is like we ended gold redemptions for the public in the 30s. Mm-hmm. So no longer did that note on it say redeemable for gold. No, that ended, right? So other governments could still redeem dollars for gold at the central bank level until 71, but they could, you know, citizens could no longer do that, right?
Theoretically, they could. There was always a gentleman's agreement that they don't. That's why it broke down when the French tried to actually take them at the gold. I mean,
No. Governments could do it until 71. I'm saying it was illegal. Citizens could not even own gold in the United States.
I know. Since 33, but they didn't really. The governments could take the gold, but they didn't really, you know. They were like, when you called Washington and you said, I want my gold, and they said, really? You know, do you really want to think about it again?
No. Sorry, we're getting things confused here. I'm not talking about foreign governments. I'm talking about citizens of the United States.
I know. No. I'm
gentleman's agreement. They literally had their stuff stolen from them by the government.
Yes. Absolutely. That's and Satoshi Nakamoto had this in his birthday, right? 5th of April.
Other governments continued to draw down the U.S. gold reserves. The U.S. gold reserves were massive in the 50s. They were only a small percentage of that amount in terms of ounces by 1970. And by 1971, the rate at which other countries were drawing down and redeeming their dollars for gold was so alarming that Nixon had to stop it. So the point is that like there are many different ways historically for governments to kind of force upon the population an easy money credit system and take the hard assets. They've been doing this for decades, for centuries. This is what Bitcoin is a response to.
The perfect example we see right now is Turkey, right? Which is very important for Europeans. There's millions of Turkish people living in Western Europe, especially Germany and Austria. Erdogan is basically completely ruining the lira. He literally said that he's at war with Bitcoin, which was a first, you know, like actually saying it. And I read an article that when you have dollars or euros with Turkish banks, they actually use that money to buy government bonds. So if you're also not safe if you think you have hard currency. Turks are very young, people who if you go on Twitter and you just go on the Bitcoin hashtag, it's like every third tweet is Turkish. So what do you think we'll see next? Do we really see authoritarian governments be toppled by Bitcoin? And how would that look like?
Well, I think that it's a long game, and it's a transformation of the world, and it's gradual. But essentially, we're moving into a future where it's possible for citizens to have like more and more economic power. It's like a reversal of everything that was done in the last century. So in the last century, citizens could work and earn an asset that could not be inflated, right? Gold. I mean, if they chose to, they could convert their earnings into gold. So that ability was essentially taken from them, and they could only reasonably save and use money or assets that were, that could be debased by the state. There's already it's interesting. The United States, there are 14. I learned this yesterday. There are 14 states in the United States that are either researching or implementing or have implemented, like in the case of Utah, the ability for citizens to settle debts in gold. There's already like a rising kind of movement in the United States to kind of go back to a standard where citizens can do commerce in a currency that's not inflatable. So, and that's being driven by people who probably don't know a whole lot about Bitcoin. So there's like a public populist kind of frustration with the current system. So I think that what you see is in all countries, like over the coming decade and beyond, like more and more people waking up to the fact that they can choose to use Bitcoin. As far as like toppling governments, I think this is not a violent transition. This isn't like a war. Bitcoin is a peaceful revolution. It's going to take time. But what it essentially does is it forces these governments to have these dilemmas, and the rising value of Bitcoin versus fiat currencies will make the choice for them in the end. They will have to adopt Bitcoin. And again, they will try to have it both ways. They will try to have some system where they'll say, you still have to use this fiat currency, and give us your Bitcoin and we'll give you all this fiat currency. I mean, they're going to try all these different schemes. It's not going to work because Bitcoin is free speech. You can have it. You can memorize the private key to an address in your head, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is not like gold. It is not confiscatable and centralized in the same way. Mm-hmm. It is not held by government. I mean, by the 20th century, gold was held by governments, essentially. I mean, the majority of it, right? The majority of Bitcoin is held by people, individuals, users, all around the world, unbeknownst to each other. This is a totally different system. So, really the main driver is that the value of Bitcoin continues to increase, value of fiat currencies continues to decrease. Governments will be forced to adopt Bitcoin. They'll try to have it both ways. In the end, they won't be able to, and the population will learn about Bitcoin and start using it. Okay. So immediately what you start seeing is a reduction in what the state does. So, in the first few years of this phenomenon, I think what becomes immediately more restrictive is unnecessary wars abroad that these countries are fighting. They'll have to focus inward. The only way that the US government, for example, can finance the global war on terror currently is because we can borrow for it. Okay? It's because our debt is very valuable. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that we've waged have been paid for entirely by borrowing. We've actually paid $1 trillion on interest on those wars alone so far. We have trillions more to pay before we pay back the money that we borrowed. from the private sector, from other governments, etc. So if all of a sudden the US government, you know, there's not as much of a demand for US debt, then they have a problem. And that problem is already, that problem already happened, like in the last 15 years, foreign governments stopped buying US debt. So in response, the US government started buying its debt in a very significant way. So you have major, major intervention of the US government in the bond markets today. So this being done through traditional Fed operations and then through QE, the straight up purchase of long-term bonds. So
all kinds of acronyms.
Yeah. But I mean, in general, you have like the US government intervening in bond markets to keep yields low and to keep interest rates low and to make the price of borrowing cheaper. That only works up to a certain point. At a certain point when US debt becomes less credible, they can't do that. They're going to have to raise the rates of interest to attract foreign capital. This has happened before in our history numerous times. So at that point, it becomes very expensive to wage war abroad. Very, very expensive. I mean, just to give you a sense, I have a number here I'll just read to you. Every 1% hike to short-term interest rates costs the Treasury Department $150 billion a year in interest payments, which amounts to 4% of the total budget of the United States. So, you know, we're at essentially zero, right? We're between zero and one in terms of the Fed funds rate. Like if we're hiking to a reasonable 5-6%, right? I mean, you're talking maybe almost $1 trillion more a year that we have to pay. And that starts to account for 15-25% of the federal budget. Okay. So what I'm saying is that like over the coming decade, as the use of Bitcoin rises and as the value rises and as more and more people use it, this scheme that governments have been running with fiat currencies to finance stuff becomes less possible and less sustainable. And they're going to have to choose more wisely what they spend their money on. So some of the first victims of the transition to the Bitcoin standard over the coming decades are going to be extraneous foreign wars that are not relevant to the population, that they don't really care about. The things that the public cares about the most are going to be, no, they're not going away, but like stuff that like is wasteful and irrelevant to people's lives gets cut out. So that's my main thesis here, as far as like what to expect in democracies. In dictatorships, I mean, it's going to be very unstable. Again, Bitcoin is not an army. It doesn't have weapons. It's not going to go fight and kill somebody. But a dictator, if this dictator is unable to print the money to keep themselves afloat, massive instability, and they'll get overthrown. I mean, you've seen that time and time again in history. Look what happened to Suharto in the late 90s in Indonesia. I mean, if the currency collapses to a certain extent, it's very hard for the government to sustain its grip on power. It basically has to become much more vicious. That's essentially where we're headed.
It's been on a global monetary system perspective. We've known for decades that, you know, one country giving out printing the reserve currency is not a long term solution to anything. The Triffin dilemma. Even at some point, the country has other interests than and needs another monetary policy than the rest of the world does. My question is simple. When you think it through, isn't Bitcoin, especially for the US, the perfect solution in a way? I mean, the combination of a sound currency with American capitalistic society. Could crush China, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So my thought is that there's a transitionary period, and then there's like the future. In the future, I don't think we use fiat currencies. I mean, I think we use Bitcoin in the future. But in this transitionary period, which could be decades, eventually governments are going to realize how important Bitcoin is, and they're going to have to start integrating it into their fiat currencies. What I mean by that is, you know, you'll have some sort of Bitcoin exchange standard, which would be similar to the gold exchange standard, which existed for obviously decades and was really the blueprint for the Bretton Woods. Was essentially, you all use dollars and, you know, you can redeem them for a certain amount of Bitcoin, right? So I think that you could see governments basically starting to accumulate a Bitcoin position and having Bitcoin activity in their country, mining, commerce, you know, rules, human rights related to it, et cetera, et cetera. And the value of that fiat currency will depend in no small, you know, amount on the Bitcoin position of that country. And the ability for that country to borrow will depend on the health of its Bitcoin reserve. Okay. And this will dictate policy in a similar way to how the gold standard worked, like in an ideal sense. But eventually, as Bitcoin over time, its price eventually stabilizes, like you're just not, like, merchants aren't going to want your fiat. They're just not. Like, there's only so much that governments can do to force you to use fiat. Like, today we have Gresham's Law. People who are privileged enough to have to consider Bitcoin as like a savings thing, which is like a financial privilege point of view. Yeah, I mean, we're going to use fiat and save the Bitcoin. But a lot of people can't, you know, a lot of people don't have that luxury. I mean, Bitcoin's the only money they have. And eventually what you're going to see is like merchants and service providers, and you've already started to see this, but like this will really come into effect in the coming decades. Like they will prefer the Bitcoin and they will actually have a premium on the Bitcoin, and they'll be willing to accept, you know, slightly less Bitcoin compared to the exchange rate than they would fiat. There will be a discount on fiat. Like they're not going to want it. And that's really what's going to drive what you see in dollarizing countries called Thiers' Law, where the good money actually drives out the bad, the opposite of Gresham's Law. This is what eventually happens. Like, why would I use your fiat currency if we could just all use Bitcoin? It's programmable. It's instant. The fees are essentially virtually free on the Lightning Network. We can use it as it's a perfect medium of exchange from a technological point of view. And eventually, I believe that's what we'll use. But there will be this long transitionary period, which will be fascinating to live through and observe as governments grapple with this thing.
But you think it will be peaceful? What about you know, the way?
Well, there's no meaning. There's no Bitcoin army. Like there's no, like there's, it's, yes. I mean,
you can buy an army if you own enough Bitcoin in the future. I mean, if it really, you know, if number goes up and
but
up.
Let me reframe your question. Who will they be fighting against? Like, give me an example. Like, let's say let's say you're the Cuban government and your citizens are using Bitcoin. I mean, who are you going to fight? I mean, it's not like something where it leads to necessarily a civil war. There's no, like, if everybody's using Bitcoin, there is no like Bitcoin party. Like, it's like email. Like, we use email today because it's better than post, sending something in the mail. Not because we care about who created email or the ideology behind email. We use it because it's better for communication. Everybody's going to use Bitcoin because it's better money than fiat currency. But like, that's just not well understood right now.
Explain it right now. There was a time when we all made email addresses, but we didn't know what to do with them. That's basically what Bitcoin is.
But right. Like the point of the violence or peace thing is like, it just makes things harder for dictatorships, and they will rise and fall according to traditional means. If people will rise up and topple them, or they'll collapse, or someone will step forward and offer reform. That won't change, but the incentives for those things to happen sooner than they normally would will change, because these governments won't be able to control their fiat currency and keep themselves alive by, like, you know, essentially taxing out the population and stealing from them. So you'll see like a quicker or a less stable dictatorship. So let's put it that way.
There's a lot of talk about inequality in the world today, and most Bitcoiners know that it's mostly the money printing, the Cantillon effect, all of that stuff. But what about inequality within the Bitcoin system? What's the answer? Because there is one argument is the environmental impact, and there is very, yes, you said this in the mainstream media is all over it, no question. And the other thing is like inequality within the Bitcoin system. Whales who have accumulated early will be fabulously rich, right? Mm-hmm. How do you answer that?
It's true. If you bought a lot of Bitcoin or mined a lot of Bitcoin 10 years ago, and you've had the wisdom to not sell it, which is highly mm-hmm. unlikely, I would add, just think about it. If you got a bunch of Bitcoin at $1, are you going to seriously not sell it at $30 or $100 or $500 or $1,000? Like, for you to really be a believer early on was crazy. To be a believer today is not crazy. Bitcoin has become way less risky over time. But mm-hmm. in those early years, I mean, you really had to be crazy to think that this thing was going to take over the world. Like 2009, 10, 11, 12. Like, are you kidding me? So it was not, it has not been easy to hold. It's not like people got lucky. No, like most people sold or forgot their, you know, password or whatever. Very few people like held a very significant sum from those very, very early days. Very, very few people. Now, the thing is, Bitcoin is not something that is an inequality first protocol. Like it actually fights the ability of a state to do violent redistribution of wealth. Like it is a equality of opportunity machine. It's not an equality of outcome machine. It makes it so that everybody uses the same money and there's no discrimination. It does not address, you know, the fact that some people can buy a lot more Bitcoin than others. It just doesn't.
We just have to get over that.
Well, I mean, that's something that has to be solved elsewhere. Like through, mm-hmm. If you believe it's a problem to be solved, then that's a government system. It's not a money system thing. It won't be, at least in the Bitcoin standard. There will, however, be significant inequality reduction, I believe, in a Bitcoin standard due to the fact that the rich can't just sort of get richer and richer and richer. Ever since we've had what you would describe like, either like in a macro sense, the post 71 fiat economy, at least in my country, which of course trickles down everywhere else, or even since Greenspan's easy money policies really started in earnest in the late to mid 1990s, preceding the dot-com bubble and the later subprime mortgage crisis and great financial crisis, the percentage of Americans holding the percentage of wealth that 1% of the Americans, the top 1% hold, has increased from 24% to 32% since the mid-90s. So, you know, in our easy money system, the rich get richer. I mean, this is most,
yeah.
And when they print, and when the monetary supply, I don't mean the total amount of money, but like the government created monetary amount of money is increased, it benefits the insiders first. This can be seen most obviously by how absurdly rich the already rich got in the last 2 years during the pandemic time, which is
lots
grotesque.
Of headlines about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's just headlines today about how yachts are, there's no more yachts. You can't buy a yacht because
no, it's horrible
because they bought them all. That. Yeah. Yeah. No, they bought them all. So, and that's not because of supply chain crisis. No, that's because of monetary policy. It's because of a creation of easy money. So when you have the Bitcoin standard, there's just, I mean, it's impossible to describe all the changes that will occur because they're so far reaching and deep and profound, but like you will not have this like regime of easy money where companies are more valuable because of the debt they sell than the actual products they make. You won't have this reality where it's as easy to do stock buybacks, which enrich the stockholders, as opposed to invest in the company's future. These things are made possible by what's known as ZIRP or zero interest rate policy, which is a combination of, in America, quantitative easing, you know, the central government buying long-term treasury bonds and subprime mortgage securities, things like that. In addition to this, like idea of keeping the interest rates very low.
So, we have negative interest rates here. So
exactly. But that's financial
Germans
repression.
Love it.
I mean, but that's financial repression. I mean, you don't love it if you're a saver. I mean,
no, I was joking.
No.
The German people are, yeah.
No, but the central banks love it, actually. That's why they want these programmable central bank digital currencies.
But what's going to happen with central banks? Well, that's my question.
But the point is that, like, when you can't lower the interest rate anymore and you can't encourage people to spend or borrow, then you force them to with negative rates. You literally force them to. And that's financial repression. And, you know, all these tactics will be like amplified through central bank digital currencies, which I view as like a major, major threat to civil liberties.
I do too.
But, you know, essentially the point being that the Bitcoin standard has far-reaching effects that we can't possibly predict today, and we're going to have to chart and research and study as we move into the future. But like, what I'm basically getting at is like, you know, there are a lot of extravagant things that are done with money today at the government level that will simply not be possible in the Bitcoin standard. Now, as far as central banks, I mean, look, Bitcoin was invented to replace central banks. So in one sense, central banks are living on borrowed time here, to be clear.
Do you think they'll
exist for a while until they're no longer needed? I mean, until they're no longer relevant. And I think the same thing goes for the IMF and the World Bank and all these alphabet soup organizations. The Bitcoin standard reduces the need for all of these financial bureaucracies to exist. There will always be a need for nation states, as long as they exist, to do finance, right? So they will have a bank, and they will have revenue from taxation and from selling their debt. But their debt will be priced very differently when it cannot be quietly inflated in value by debt monetization. In a world where the reserve currency is not the US dollar, but actually Bitcoin. Like, this just changes everything when it comes to that. So the government will still have a finance department. It will hold a variety of assets, I would imagine mostly Bitcoin, in the future. And it will issue debt. I mean, if it has to build a bridge, like, and it doesn't have enough income from taxes to pay for that bridge or whatever, it will try to issue debt. But the price that you're going to have to offer, the interest rate you're going to have to offer on that debt is going to be very high compared to today. Very, very high. You know, I'm not going to want to give the government my money unless, if I could just have Bitcoin, unless they're going to outperform Bitcoin, like, over a certain duration. So that's just going to be very interesting. But I view the end game here as like a world where there's just a lot less opportunity for financial repression, for things like, you know, inflation to be, you know, way above, interest rates. This financial repression thing just, you know, goes out the window. We have a different base money, and all the countries in the world share the same base money. And I think that's a really beautiful vision, actually.
I agree. I do absolutely agree. The question is, I mean, I asked about the central banks because what I see right now is it's only a small thing, but it's fascinating. It's like, we had this a week ago, it was, the papers were saying, you know, Russia wants to ban Bitcoin, right? But it wasn't Russia. It wasn't Putin. It wasn't the government. It was the central bank. And then a week later, the actual government said, no, we're not going to ban it. You know, get your shit together. And think about something else, you know? And we had the same thing in Argentina where the president actually said, he's looking into Bitcoin, like, and like a couple of hours later, the central bank chief was panicking. Because central banks are their own sovereign entities, right? In most countries, the Swiss police cannot go into the building of the Bank of International Settlements. They are protected by all kinds of contracts. So dismantling this system is nothing that happens overnight.
That's okay. So to conclude, I mean, when it comes to dictatorship and these like systems that some of us would wish to be dismantled or destroyed. The point is that Bitcoin doesn't do that. Bitcoin doesn't destroy. Bitcoin doesn't commit violence. Bitcoin is a new incentive paradigm where people will dismantle the systems themselves. It is a new framework for thinking about money and our relationship to one another. And it's a new world where being a dictator or a tyrant and committing vast numbers of systematic human rights abuses is much harder to do, because where are you going to get the money from it? For it, rather. This idea of like lording over people through control of the economy, it's just going to be a lot harder. So, I mean, we're very, very early days. I mean, where you can most obviously see this idea of like, and you say your editors like, well, how will Bitcoin topple governments? Well, we're in the early stage here. What's inarguable is that Bitcoin is being used by tens of millions of people around the world as a powerful human rights tool to protect themselves and their families and to connect with the outside world. And you're starting to see governments be very panic. I mean, you're starting to see them panic in two ways. You're starting to see them trying to ban it or design laws to restrict its use. This has been happening for the last 5 years, like on and off everywhere. It doesn't work. I mean, how many times did the Chinese government try to ban Bitcoin? It doesn't work. You know, then the next idea is let's just tax it a lot. So the Indian government just released today, a very repressive sort of tax. And maybe they'll try that route. That's kind of what I was describing with what the Cubans do. They'll try to sort of confiscate as much as they can. And, you know, eventually they'll launch these central bank digital currencies and try to compete with it. But I think the population will look at these two things and be like, well, maybe I'm forced to use the CBDC, like it's state-run stores in a communist country. You won't be able to use Bitcoin to buy stuff. Great, but I'm gonna keep my savings in Bitcoin, and I'm only gonna buy whatever CBDCs I need to buy stuff. Like that's such a grotesque kind of forced system, and it's a system that will, I think, deteriorate over time into the future. So
it's extremely dangerous also, you know, telling the populace, you know, now we talk about digital money. Let's talk about digital money. There's digital money here. It's like the old money. There is no real difference. There's just the surveillance is better. That is CBDCs. There's not, for me and you, there's no difference on the bank account, right? There isn't. But one last question, because I know you have to go. So let me ask you one last question. What are they going to do with all the gold? The US ended the gold standard to keep the gold, right?
Yeah, I mean, Well, currently you have governments around the world competing to buy more gold, but that's because they don't really understand the Bitcoin paradigm yet. Once Bitcoin is properly understood, gold will lose most of its monetary value and be reduced to its industrial and cosmetic value, which is, you know, whatever it is, 10 to 20% of its current monetary value. And it won't be used by governments to do central banking or any sort of international settlement. That will be completely subsumed by Bitcoin. That's my view. And that will take place, probably this decade. I mean, a lot of the things I'm describing are much more long-term, but mm-hmm. the world understanding that Bitcoin is a better, like, kind of rock solid fundamental store of value than gold is going to happen pretty quickly.
But you don't see any reason at all why Bitcoin could fail, because then, you know, you would have to go back to the gold, right?
Not really. I mean, it's hard. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm here doing this is because I've thought long and hard about that, and I don't really see it. I mean, it takes advantage of our base human impulses, and it feeds into that to create its own future. I think that governments are forced to adopt it as opposed to ban it eventually. I mean, it's kind of like asking, like, will the internet fail? I mean, mm-hmm. there are going to be problems with the internet, yes. But like, if I sat here in 1995 and you asked me, don't you think there's some way the internet could fail? I mean, and I said, no, I can't really think of a way it would fail. I wouldn't be, you know, maybe at the time you'd be like, well, you're crazy. But I'd be right. And I feel like that's kind of where we are with Bitcoin. There's going to be problems and issues and all kinds of things. But like, it's a funny concept to me to think of it as like, it's not going to be around anymore. Like it's here to stay. So it deserves our reflection and study. And I would encourage you to learn as much about it as possible.
Alex, thank you so much. Thank you. We can be glad the internet didn't fail, because otherwise we couldn't be talking. Have a great day. Thank you for taking the time.
Take care.
Danke fürs Zuhören bei dieser Folge von Was Bitcoin bringt. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, bitte hinterlasst uns 5 Sterne bei Apple und bei Spotify, folgt uns auf YouTube, schickt uns eure Eindrücke, eure Ideen, eure Anregungen, eure Vorschläge für Gäste und natürlich auch eure Kritik an hallo@wasbitcoinbringt.com. Was nicht unerwähnt bleiben darf, natürlich auch Value for Value. Dieser Podcast läuft über das Lightning-Netzwerk in allen Kanälen. Man kann streamen, man kann spenden. Es gibt einen Spenden-Button auch auf wasbitcoinbringt.com inzwischen. Und diese Dinge sind auch wahnsinnig motivierend, wenn da ein bisschen was reinkommt, wenn jeder das nutzt. Es macht wirklich viel Freude, als Bitcoiner für Bitcoiner zu arbeiten.
Die Veröffentlichungen in diesem Podcast sowie die darin enthaltenen Hinweise, die im Begleitmaterial gesetzten Links, dienen ausschließlich Informationszwecken und stellen weder eine Anlageberatung, Anlageanalyse noch eine Aufforderung oder Empfehlung zum Erwerb oder Verkauf von Finanzinstrumenten dar. Insbesondere kann eine Anlage oder sonstige Beratung dadurch nicht ersetzt werden. Die in den Veröffentlichungen erhaltenen Angaben basieren auf dem Wissensstand zum Zeitpunkt der Ausarbeitung und können jederzeit ohne weitere Benachrichtigungen geändert werden. Die Inhalte richten sich ausschließlich an natürliche Personen. Es wird keine Haftung für die Richtigkeit, Vollständigkeit oder Aktualität der zur Verfügung gestellten Informationen, Informationsquellen, daraus resultierenden Haftungen oder Schäden jedweder Art übernommen. Eine Haftung für leicht fahrlässiges Verhalten wird jedenfalls ausgeschlossen.